Welcome back. Part two, the B block of In the Dark. I'm Jim Peters. Joining us on the phone from New York City is Levi Browdy. And Levi, I forgot to ask you, you are the official spokesperson for Falun Gong, is that right, in the United States? Is that correct?
Not exactly. I'm the executive director of a nonprofit called the Falun Dafa Information Center that focuses on reporting on what's happening with Falun Gong in China and around the world.
Oh, okay. Very good. Very good. So I want to start here for our listeners because I was telling my wife I was going to do this interview today, and she didn't know what Falun Gong was. So I just want to start here. I've talked about this in the past on the show, but still, can you explain to our listeners what Falun Gong is?
Sure. So Falun Gong, which is also known as Falun Dafa, that's its more formal name, but it's the same thing. So Falun Gong is a Buddhist-based meditation practice from China. They call it a Qigong practice. Qigong is often referred to as like Chinese yoga. So practices like these Qigong practices were very popular in China for hundreds and actually even thousands of years. Falun Gong is one of those practices. It was first made public in 1992, and it became very, very popular in the 90s. And by 1999, there were 100 million people practicing it. To practice Falun Gong really means to do the meditation, the slow motion exercise that looks a lot like Tai Chi, and also to study the principles of Falun Gong, which, again, are Buddhist-based teachings all centered around three core principles: truthfulness, compassion, and tolerance.
And like Buddhism, it's not really a religion, right? I mean, I would say Buddhism is more a philosophy or practice than a religion. But is that how you describe this, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. It's really a religion, particularly because it doesn't have any of the structural things of religion. There's no churches or clergy or membership even. If you want to practice Falun Gong, you go down to the local park where they probably have a little practice site. A volunteer teaches you the exercises and meditation. You can download the books for free online, and you start studying, and away you go. And you're practicing.
And from what I understand, this is by design that there's no centralized place or the founder of Falun Gong. This was the idea, right? Is that you don't have to join anything. You just do it, correct?
That's exactly right. I mean, from what I remember back in the 90s when he made the practice public, he wanted to do just that. Make it public, let people have access to the whole teachings, and then they can adopt those teachings into their lives without any kind of membership or any kind of organizational involvement.
And why did this take off in China so quickly? Do you know?
Yeah, there are two reasons. One is it was a very effective Qigong for health. So very quickly, people were like, chronic problems were going away. They could sleep better. Health problems, even very serious health problems, started going away. And then people started talking in China, and word spread very quickly. But there was a second component, and that in, you have to understand, modern China, they've, since 1949, when the communists took over, there's been decades and decades of these horrific campaigns, very violent in nature, aimed to stamp out traditional Chinese culture, something that's 5,000 years old. Well, the essence of Falun Gong really comes from traditional Chinese culture. It brings back all those original principles of everything from kindness and truthfulness to filial piety. And a lot of these traditional values are integrated or part of, you are reflected in Falun Gong, and people saw that. And that became, you know, I remember hearing once one of the other Chinese men I was talking to when I first started practicing myself, and he said, you know, Falun Gong was really like a cult. It was our renaissance. It was the renaissance of Chinese culture. And we looked at it and we said, oh, the great things of our traditional past have now come back.
So from what I understand, when it started in 92 and for several years after that, the Chinese Communist government was actually all for this. And from what I understand, partly it was because of what you just brought up here, the fact that, well, when you have a communist government, you're paying for medical bills, and it was actually dropping the medical costs of the populace. Is that correct?
Absolutely. The government was very supportive. They actually invited the founder, Li Hongzhi, to come and give teachings to their security bureaus and different places. And actually, what you just said is very important, because the Zhu Rongji, who was essentially the vice president of the country at that time, the number two person in the country, he was quoted in the U.S. News and World Report in 99 saying exactly what you just said. We love Falun Gong and Qigong's like it because it's reducing health costs tremendously. And so it's something we very much support and applaud.
So what happened? In 1999, there was basically a complete about face as far as the CCP was concerned regarding this practice. What happened?
Three things came together to sort of build a perfect storm. The first is that the Chinese government did a survey to find out just how many people are practicing and found that there were 70 to 100 million people. That's tens of millions more than there are members of the Communist Party.
Yeah.
One out of every 13 people in China was practicing Falun Gong by the end of the 90s. So that number, it doesn't matter what you're doing, you can be basket weaving, that number of people doing something that's not communism made a couple leaders nervous. The second was this almost this spiritual cultural renaissance that Falun Gong represented. You know, this is something that they'd spent decades trying to stamp out because they wanted to impose Marxist communist values on the Chinese people. And along comes this traditional thing. That was the second reason. The third thing, and what was really the trigger, was that the top man in the country, a man named Jiang Zemin, who's the head of the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, he was the first leader who had not gone through the Communist Revolution. He had very little street cred among his peers. He was desperately trying to build up a cult of personality around himself, very much like Chairman Mao and others had done. And along comes Falun Gong, and it's all everybody's talking about. And he was the one who finally said, kill it, eradicate this practice. And there was a big power struggle in the summer of 1999, because a lot of the senior members of the Chinese government were like, what are you talking about? This is a great thing. I'm not going to do this. But he ultimately prevailed. And so in July of 1999, it became, if you were a Falun Gong practitioner or even a supporter, you're now enemy of the state. You can be taken from your bed in the middle of the night, thrown into prison, thrown into a labor camp, tortured and killed.
Okay, Mr. Brody, here's the deal. I'm a real naive person. I admit it. I'm a naive jackass. And how can you run a country? Now, I understand they're communists. I'm a first-generation American. Both my parents are from communist countries. So I have no love of communism whatsoever. As a matter of fact, I spent a lot of time on this program bashing communists and even the Chinese. There's no different. But I don't understand if you're running the Chinese country with a 5,000-year-old tradition of, like you said, compassion, tolerance, et cetera, et cetera. First of all, why would you want to kill that? And secondly, how can you? It's like, I'm just a stupid dork here, or what's going on?
No, I mean, this is actually, I think it's actually a very intelligent question, because it's something that almost everyone I encounter in the West, and I myself had that question. It took me years kind of to study modern Chinese history to kind of wrap my mind around this, because they don't teach this in schools. We learn about the Bolsheviks in Russia. We learn about the Nazis. What we don't learn about is that starting in 1949, when the communists took over, they ruled by letting loose waves upon waves of very violent campaigns. And the whole purpose of these campaigns was to destroy segments of society that would challenge communist ideology and rule. So when they first came to power in 49, they would go out, for example, and kill the landlord's entire families to destroy and redistribute the land. Then years later, they'd go after the intellectuals. Then they go after the capitalists. Then they go after the entrepreneurs. Then they went after academics. It was wave upon wave of campaign, and it's all centered around making sure the people live in fear and getting rid of ideologies that they feel could threaten their 100% grip on power. And with Falun Gong, it was very much, I mean, first of all, it's not like the leaders of the CCP are economic wizards or industrial wizards or political wizards. They're propagandists. That's how they seize power. That's how they know how to keep power. And so when along came Falun Gong, it was real. What people don't realize is this wasn't just one horrific persecution out of the blue. This is the latest in a long line of terribly violent campaigns that are aimed at destroying any kind of perceived threat in terms of ideology, in terms of freedom of thought.
Okay, but fill me in here, though.
Yeah.
I'm under the impression that after Mao Zedong passed away and the Cultural Revolution was over, for a while, Let's be, I'm going to be realistic here and relativistic. They weren't doing that much. Am I right about that?
You are. The body counts went way down. But there was a few reasons for that. One of the reasons was this unspoken contract with the Chinese people after Tiananmen Square, which was basically this. We're going to open up the country. If you want to get rich, that's fine. You want to go to school. You want to lift yourself up to the middle class. That's fine. But stay in your lane. Do not get political. Do not engage in anything that, at least the CCP sees it, could represent a threat to their ideological power and their hold. And that agreement, that unspoken agreement, kind of was what sort of carried China through the 90s. I have many Chinese friends who tell the story that, you know, they were devastated one way or the other in Tiananmen Square, you know, and their parents were like, just, they'd given up on the country, on the leadership. They're telling their kids, look, just get out. Just get out. Get in a good school and get out of the country. And so that relative calm that you're speaking about was really that the aftermath of Tiananmen Square. And it really, that was only 10 years. If you think of 89 and then Falun Gong was introduced in 1992, and the persecution started in 1999. So from 89 to 99, there was a heavy focus on, look, just keep your head down, be quiet, don't make any trouble, try and make some money, and everything will be okay.
Well, I have friends who lived in China. These are Americans, not Chinese nationalists or people. But my friends who live in China told me at that time, they told me, as long as you don't mess with the government, you could pretty much do whatever you wanted. It was more or less, there was kind of a more or less, like you said, an unspoken freedom of economically, at least. You could start a business, you could do whatever, as long as you didn't mess with the government or try to do anything or try to change the government's mind or anything like that, basically the government left you alone. So that's kind of what you're saying, right? Am I right about that?
I think you are, but I think it's not just governmental sort of policy thing. It also extends into areas of religious or spiritual life. And I think what often was missed is that there was a tremendous void, and has been really for decades, ever since the communists took over. But I think it was accentuated in the 90s, where, you know, where they're letting loose a little bit on economic freedom, saying, okay, get a job, make some money. But there was still there was a horrific spiritual void. And I think so anybody who raised their head, not just in terms of government policy, but also raised their head and said, you know what, this is what I want to believe, this is what makes my life better, was not really allowed.
And so correct me here too, I'm also under the impression that since that time, or roughly since 2000 and let's say 1999, when this whole thing with Falun Gong started, that basically they have cracked down on the economic aspects of this freedom too now. Am I also right about that?
Well, they've certainly weaponized the economics. And this is another thing to understand with a communist society, particularly a Chinese communist society, is that everything, there's no such thing as an independent NGO or independent university or independent company. Every company is of a certain size, for example, have someone who's officially the Communist Party liaison in that company. So everything, they have their hands in pretty much every segment of society and can pull levers when they need to if any one of those segments or people in those areas step out of line.
So tell us about the persecution now, the people how does this work in the sense that, okay, so they've cracked down on Falun Gong practice. So I assume people are not getting together in the parks to do this anymore. Am I right about this? Or is it gone underground?
That's correct.
Has it gone underground? Or, you know, is it still manifesting itself in China at all? Or is it
there? Yeah. No, that's very much so. I mean, so the way I think the first part of your question is how this actually unfolded. And the way it unfolded, you know, I had mentioned in the 90s, you know, Falun Gong was quite popular. Everybody sort of knew about it. So when the head guy in the CCP decided to eradicate Falun Gong, he actually set up an entirely new office that reports directly to him in the Politburo outside of any sort of legal framework, called the 610 office, what the human rights organizations now call the Gestapo for Falun Gong. And so this is a security apparatus that has jurisdiction over all police forces and other security forces, and their sole job is to convert, what they call convert or brainwash, a Falun Gong practitioner to give up his belief. And that is done by incarcerating them in mass, putting them in labor camps, prison camps, black jails, rampant use of torture, rampant instances of people dying from torture. And then in the mid-2000s up until today, probably the most horrific aspect of this is using these, you know, more than a million Falun Gong that are held in various places around China as living donors, so that when they can match an organ for someone who's flying into China and needs a heart or a liver or a kidney or something, they'd kill the Falun Gong practitioner, extract their organ, and do the organ transplantation. So this has fueled an enormous business in China, and it's really, it's Jiang Zemin's final solution for Falun Gong. So that's what the persecution has looked like and continues very much to this day. One other thing you brought about going underground, and this is, I think, a very important aspect of, no, they don't, Falun Gong don't get together in parks freely in China. They'd be arrested if they did that. But there are tens of millions of people still practicing, and not only are they practicing, they have formed what is the largest peaceful civil disobedience movement in the world. In the tens of millions, for example, many print out leaflets about the human rights abuses they face, or even the terrible history of the actual terrible history of the CCP, into newsletters or VCDs or things like that. And usually under cover of night, they distribute this to the front doors of their neighbors in their village or their town or their city. And this has been going on for more than a decade, and it has reached just an enormous amount of Chinese people. And it's one source outside of the state run media where they can finally learn, well, this is what the CCP really is about. This is really how they came to power. This is what they're really doing to Falun Gong. And they also get important news coming from outside the country that Falun Gong people sometimes put into the newsletter that they would never hear about from the state run media. So it has gone underground, but it is very active in trying to awaken the Chinese people to what's really going on with the CCP.
So I would never accuse any politician anywhere on the planet, regardless of the government type, of ever being brilliant. But did it ever occur to these people, the CCP, that if they've just left this alone, it probably ultimately would have benefited them? Do you think this has occurred to anybody?
Yeah, that was, I mentioned when the top man said eradicate this, I think that was exactly what you just said, was at the heart of the power struggle that ensued. Because in the communist country, the Politburo, which I think was at 7 people at that time, that's sort of the most powerful, we'd call it, executive branch of the country. They run the country. And even members of the Politburo had like friends and family members practicing Falun Gong. They'd read the Falun Gong book. They were like, what are you talking about? And that, what you just said, is the essence of that power struggle. Because they were saying, this is great for the country. Unfortunately, that top man, he was very much trained in the hardcore communist ideal that you eliminate any threat, no matter what, no matter any other factors. And he saw in Falun Gong, this was something that people were embracing spiritually. They're embracing it in their daily lives. And although it was great for the country, and a lot of the other leadership saw that, he didn't, and he won the day.
So tell me, Mr. Brody, how bad is this? For example, if I'm in my basement and doing the exercises and reading the book and I don't talk to anybody and a neighbor of mine snitches on me, am I going to get arrested? Is it that bad?
Very, very possible. Yeah, very possible. People are, this is not uncommon in communist countries that they do sort of weaponize the whole populace. So if you are a police officer, you get rewarded for the amount of Falun Gong practitioners you detain and quote-unquote brainwash or transform.
Oh, wonderful. Fantastic.
By the same token, if I'm in a workplace and there's a Falun Gong person, sometimes the whole workplace could be punished in some regards. So they're incentivized to rat on that person, say, hey, here's a Falun Gong person. You should take him away to a brainwashing center. Now, having said that, this peaceful civil disobedience movement has made inroads. And this is like the one few really bright spots. There are pockets in China, sometimes a village, sometimes, a section of a town or a city where because the Falun Gong people have gone out and they've handed out these leaflets and they've actually openly talked to many of the leaders in these areas, they've decided to take a turn a blind eye approach and sometimes even protect the practitioner in their area from the higher ups in the CCP chain. So there are pockets in China that people are like, I'm not doing this anymore. Forget it. You know, and even kind of protecting Falun Gong. Now, those are isolated pockets. Overall, the country, the policy is still very draconian. And if you are a Falun Gong practitioner, you're still at risk each and every day of being hauled off to prison. But that information and that kind of movement is really changing hearts and minds, and it has had an effect.
We've talked on this program about the supposed secret police stations that were set up in New York City. And of course, you're in New York City. And now supposedly those have been shut down. But have they had any effect on Chinese nationals or even Americans practicing Falun Gong in the United States? Did any of those?
Well, okay, that's a really good point. Those particular police stations, it's hard to tell when they were first formed. It looks like we caught it pretty early and shut them down. However, very active, sometimes even thuggish, suppression of Chinese communities here, particularly Falun Gong community, by CCP agents has been going on for 20 years. And in fact, Freedom House in 2021, I believe, two years ago, came out with a landmark, a groundbreaking report that documented all what they call transnational oppression of all tyrannies around the world. And to no surprise, the Chinese government is by far the worst aggressor. And one of the key targets they go after is Falun Gong. In fact, one of the Chinese embassy officials in Australia over a decade ago defected to the West, came to the U.S., testified before Congress, and said, you guys have no idea how bad this is. Did you know that in every single Chinese diplomatic mission around the world, there is a unit, a department inside the mission whose sole focus is to malign, suppress, and silence Falun Gong in their host country? And so this has been going on for 20 years.
From what I understand, even the Epoch Times runs the Shenyang Performing Arts Unit that they have touring all over the world. I understand even those people have been constantly harassed, even when they travel in the United States from city to city. That's true.
Very much so. Now those two are separate. Shenyang's kind of its own thing, not really related to the Epoch Times, but absolutely what you said is right. I mean, Shenyang is based in New York. They have their headquarters in upstate New York, and they have, just to give you an example, they have to have people. They largely tour by bus when they go around North America. So they have to, starting about 5 or 6 years ago, they have to have someone stand outside and watch the bus 24 hours a day. Because they were finding that people were trying to vandalize the bus, and sometimes insidious ways, like not slashing the tire all the way through, but slashing it 3/4 of the way through, so that once the bus gets out onto a highway and the wheel heats up, it will explode then. Stuff like that. And so they've put pressure on theaters, they put pressure on government officials not to attend the shows. So they're very much targeted Shenyang, very much like they have targeted the Falun Gong community more broadly.
Mr. Browdy, what's the end game here? Do you see any? Can you extrapolate and see any future where one side either completely dominates this thing, or everyone gets killed, or I mean, what's going to happen here? Can you tell?
Very difficult to tell. However, I think those isolated pockets of good news, I would say, coming from China, hint at a possible future. And I think there could be a critical mass of people that have received these newsletters and sort of get sick and tired of the CCP. And you know, these people are saying, you know, I'm sick and tired of this. I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not persecuting Falun Gong. Once those people reach a critical mass, I would have to think it would have a turning point where the country is to no longer hide this, can no longer continue it. And that would bring about the end of the persecution.
I'm going to ask you one more question here, too, because this is basically about exopolitics, because we talk about this a lot here at Kong News. Our general assessment of the Chinese economy is that it's inherently it's fake. that the numbers they put out, because I mean, they have 1.6 billion people, so they have a lot of production, relatively speaking, and they do collect a good amount of taxes. But for all practical purposes, all the numbers they report are so convoluted that they basically don't matter. What do you see, if you don't mind my asking, what do you see personally as the end game of just the Chinese Communist Party in general? Do you see anything falling apart here at some point, or are they going to end up running the world, or what do you think is going to happen?
Well, in the course of working on the human rights stuff, I do come across a lot of the China watchers who are economists. And the common theme I hear them talk about is essentially saying the Chinese economy is one of the biggest Ponzi schemes in the world history.
Thank you.
Eventually it's going to collapse on itself. You know, when you see all these entire cities that they've built that are completely empty, and the only reason they build it is to show GDP numbers. I mean, stuff that is that crazy is a component of this economy. I can't imagine that can last very long.
Right. That's the same conclusion we've come to, too, for the very same reasons also. So I'm kind of glad to hear you say that. Mr. Levi Browdy, you're the executive director of the Falun Dafa Info Center. We'll put a link up to your website on our Clonk blog. I want to really thank you for joining us today. This has been a very illuminating discussion. And I think it's good that, because, like I said, my wife doesn't even know what this is. And I think a lot of people don't. And we've talked about Falun Gong on this program in the past, but I think it's really good that you just got it from the beginning and kind of from the horse's mouth. No offense there. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks. We'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Bye-bye.
That's Mr. Levi Browdy. He's the executive director of the Falun Dafa Info Center, Falun Info, which is at faluninfo.net, and we'll put that link up on the Conk blog, talking to us about what's going on with Falun Gong. And yeah, so a lot of economists, probably the majority of them, think that the whole Chinese economy is basically completely bogus. And so at some point, you can't work with fake money forever.